Good evening.
I think I'm going to stand to the side here. This pulpit seems high. I feel like a little child here. Mark and I were thinking that maybe this is your strategy to keep speakers humble. You know, you kind of feel like small when you're behind the pulpit there. But good evening. I'm glad to be here. Before we begin, I'd like to make several kind of like introductory comments to create a context for the presentation. In Luke 18, verse 8, there's a profound question when in this context, Jesus was teaching or telling about the woman who came to a judge, an unrighteous judge, and she brought her request, and the judge would not hear her. And so she just kept coming and coming and coming, and finally the judge said, and I'm reading here from the ESV, "Because this widow keeps bothering me, I will give her justice, so that she will not beat me down by her continual coming. And the Lord said, hear what the unrighteous judge says, and will not God give justice to his elect who cry to him day and night? Will he delay long over them? I tell you, he will give them justice. He will give justice to them speedily. Nevertheless," here's the question, "when the Son of Man comes, will he find faith on earth?" Now, in this context, we should not take this to mean that God is like this unrighteous judge. We have to come to him continually and beat him down until he will finally hear us. And he's actually saying, no. By contrast, he will give us speedily whatever we ask him. So in view of everything God is willing to give to us quickly when we ask him, nevertheless, when the Son of Man comes, will there be faith on earth? Will he find faith on earth? And so it's pointing, I would propose to you, it's pointing to the stubbornness and malfeasance of mankind, where we just don't appropriate everything God would give us, and therefore faith is being lost from the earth. You know, in the scripture, especially through the Old Testament, think about this phrase, children's children. God works through generations, from generation to generation, through children's children. So this question of, is there a vibrant, living faith that's transmitted from one generation to the next, is a critical question for God's people. And so how can we live our lives and structure our worship and our church to transmit faith from generation to generation in the 21st century, more than 2,000 years from when Jesus posed this question, in the times in which we live? So kind of in that context, I'll put it kind of this way, without going into a long history, there is rising up in our pews a generation of digital natives. Now, I'm going to ask for a raise of hands here. Who all remembers a time when there was not a digital world? We used to use pencils and paper. Okay, who of you have, from when you can first remember, there have been cell phones and computers and a digital world? Thank you. And sooner than the rest of us think, those who put up their hands last will be the moms and the dads sitting in these pews, and the leaders sitting up here on these benches. So I'm saying this to say the times, they are a-changing, to use that phrase. So as the times were beginning to change, there were, says the churches that we're, the constituency that we were a part of, the constituency that you were a part of, responded to these changes by, okay, there were very, let me put it this way, there were various responses within the constituency to these changes. And one of the responses is that the changing times are increasing the need for more diligent regulation. And by contrast, there were others who were saying or seeing that the digital era is rendering this defensive posture of a church to ward off change and regulate behavior by regulating devices, that is being rendered obsolete, because the time is coming as the digital world increases. In fact, I just heard someone say yesterday that in 15 years there will be Wi-Fi everywhere. And we will not be able to have enough devices, programs, and so on to protect ourselves from ourselves. We will need to have conviction in our hearts, because the only thing that will stand between us and the degradation that is being brought by the digital world, the influence that it has, the way it's shaping us and molding us, the only thing that will stand between us and us being shaped and molded by the world is the conviction in our own hearts. And so the need of the day is discipleship. And that's what led to Anabaptist disciples of Christ, a carefully chosen word. It wasn't just, well, what goes nice like ADC, okay? No, it's a strategically chosen word. We sometimes use this phrase, a movement. In fact, there's a church that we call it the Charity Movement. So what is a movement? How do movements develop? At least for our purposes here, let's describe it as a way of thinking and acting that that brings about broad-based change. So while you may not think about it right now every day, but when 5 years later, when you look back, you'll see that this dynamic has brought about change, a shift in the way God's people act and conduct their life, how they live their lives. And it's not just in one congregation, but it's across congregations and even across geographic areas. And there's this truth that has come to be a way in which we live that has caught fire, has caught hold, and it has changed the way in which we live. I would identify that as a movement. Brothers and sisters, Anabaptist Disciples of Christ is an effort to begin a discipleship movement on the basis, and I don't want to sound like a hand wringer here, but on the basis that if we do not learn to disciple one another and to hold each other accountable to live biblical lives in this digital era in which we live, and we lose the regulation that used to guide us and we don't replace it with discipleship, we're toast. Any amens to this? So, kind of on that basis, this affiliation was developed. So, I've tried to kind of lay out the case here, lay out the need. And so, is there any pushback? Like, are you sitting there thinking, "Now wait, you're overstating that"? In its time, it certainly had worked. Is subjected to definition. I mean, okay, what exactly it works? But it was a way of guiding and doing administration in church that actually transmitted faith from generation to generation. How well it was doing it, that's the question, I think. But it was a way, I guess I'd like to say. If there's nothing else, let's get started. An affiliation of conservative Anabaptist churches. Again, a carefully chosen phrase. This is an affiliation. So there are some key words here. And one of them is affiliation. And I'll explain what affiliation is and what it's not. And then also I don't think I have to make a case here for Anabaptism or an Anabaptist worldview. There is an understanding of who we are as Anabaptists and as conservative Anabaptists. So, as duly ordained Anabaptist ministers of the gospel, this was in 2000, you go back here, July 14, 2016. As duly ordained Anabaptist ministers of the gospel, we hereby establish this affiliation of conservative Anabaptist churches seeking like-minded fellowship, instruction, and accountability in church administration and congregational life in the biblical pattern of the apostolic church, to passionately follow Jesus Christ in every generation. This presentation outlines our purpose, our function, our faith proposition, and the participation agreement. So, the purpose of this affiliation is to provide, one, congregational accountability with like-minded churches. So, just like we as individuals need accountability, congregations need accountability as well. We don't always think about our congregations or our congregation in singular terms, but there is a sense in which our congregation, your congregation, has a life of its own, a life that you must pay attention to. And so this is a congregation in their life, in its life, needs accountability. And so this is an effort to provide accountability with like-minded churches while preserving congregational autonomy. So here is a key idea. The idea is that effective church administration begins at the local church level. And by contrast, I'll use the term a conference structure, where churches are members of a conference, and at the conference level there are decisions made about doctrine, about practice, and the church leaders go off to conference and they come home and they've been told about the changes that are needed. And And we often say this, think this, since we don't say it, we think this, that strong church leaders that are good for God's people are the ones who can come home from conference and tell their congregation, this is what we need to do and administrate and make that happen. I propose to you that actually produces over time weak church leaders. It takes much stronger leadership, and it makes for a stronger church when a local congregation in and of itself determines what their vision is and determines how to carry it out. And the church leaders cast the vision to the congregation and call the congregation to it. The congregation gives input, and you understand at the local church level what you're about. There's strength in that approach as compared to being treated more like a little child who gets told what is good for them, and so just go do it, and all will be well. This is the congregational autonomy is a key component in the proposition that Anabaptist Disciples of Christ brings. So by becoming a part of ADC, if you would choose to do that, you are not in any way handing over your autonomy as a congregation, the ability for you as a congregation to make decisions at the local church level. Intercongregational assistance with church work. Just when one church needs, when there are anything from ordination to all the other kind of things, when a church needs assistance, when a church has a project bigger than it can get done by themselves, then this is a way to reach out to like-minded churches to help one another. Our purpose is also the development of parachurch missions and service organizations. One of the things that is ahead of us in 2019, Lord willing, is to appoint a mission board on the basis that while each of us as a local church has the call and duty to evangelize and to send out workers in Christ's kingdom, when it comes to church planting and some of the work around the globe, we do better by pooling our efforts than each one of us individually trying to get this done. In fact, when a single congregation faces the need, it often is overwhelming, and you end up kind of getting nothing done because the need is so great in relation to the resources of just a single congregation. So it's the development of parachurch missions and service organizations. Our vision is that ADC will become a church planting affiliation. While the churches that are planted would not be like an ADC church plant, they would be a Cross Point church plant. If you would choose to become a member and you would plant a church, it would be an Antrim church plant, where the local church leaders then provide, are the local church is the sending church and provides leadership and oversight for that congregation. But this is a way of pooling our efforts with like-minded people, where workers could come from various churches and so on. But the administration would rest at the local church level. Another reason for this is, and this is kind of more just a pragmatic reason, what happens is our children become teenagers, and they go off to Bible school, and they go off into VS service, and they meet others who are at Bible school and at VS service, and they fall in love with each other, and they end up marrying one another. And so this idea of like-mindedness actually is meaningful in a multi-generational sense. So we're part of our effort here on number four is to address this question of where should our youth go? Where should our young married couples go who feel called into ministry? Number five is pastoral fellowship. Because we are autonomous churches, and because we have bivocational ministry, and all of us are called, you know, from the congregation calls us, and we're not schooled in ministry. We're called, and then we begin a journey of learning and so on. This is to provide a place of pastoral fellowship to help us become more skilled in the things that help build the local church. And we'll talk more about that. Pastoral training, it's in things like training in theology and in expository preaching and teaching. So, that's the purpose. Any questions? Interrupt me at any time if you have a question. We will have Q&A at the end, but interrupt me at any time if you have a question. But the key here is congregational accountability. Now, actually, sometimes someone asks, or the people ask, so what do you mean? How does that work? Well, because we are actually an affiliation. It's not like a conference structure where there are where the overseer will come around to check up on you. It's not structured that way at all. But on the other hand, we do know each other. Like, if you hear that something is really going off the deep end at Cross Point Mennonite in Baltic, the word will get around, and then the pastors who are associating, like-minded pastors, will talk among themselves and say, somebody better go down there and talk to those people. And that's the way it would work. Congregational accountability, but preserving congregational autonomy. Okay, what's the function? We've already talked about what we are as an affiliation. The function of this affiliation is to administrate a network of autonomous congregations, subscribing to a common statement of beliefs. In fact, which reminds me, are there handouts here somewhere? Would you want to hand those out? There are two things here, two papers you'll be receiving. The one is a paper that has everything that you're seeing up here on the paper. So you can follow along or refer to it later. The second is our statement of beliefs, and I'll talk more about the statement of beliefs later. But the point here is that ADC is not a governing body, but a planning organization. So ADC does not provide governance for congregations, but it plans events and is a network to help us accomplish more than we could on our own and to provide safety through accountability. So ADC is function is to provide planning and administration of annual assemblies for pastoral fellowship. The local or the annual meeting we called an assembly, which seemed like a safe term that doesn't say more than it intended to say. It's an assembly. It's pastors getting together for pastoral fellowship. And we've just finished in January our third, so we've had three annual assemblies. And then two, it's for pastoral networking, for counsel and resources in local church leadership and administration. It's also for intercongregational collaboration in evangelization and missions. We've already kind of covered that. And for pastoral training, resources, and events. So the function is not to be a governing organization. Here's what sometimes happens is someone will come to us and say, so at ADC, do you allow A or do you allow B? And the answer is, that is a question for your local congregation. That you can see what kind of people we are. And you can kind of tell as a congregational level that if you kind of like are like-minded and could be affiliated with us. But we don't want local church leaders to be coming to the affiliation to hear from on high what decisions about how we should live out our faith and then come back to their congregation and says, well, that's what they said, so that's what we're going to have to do. We do not want that approach at all, but push that back to the local congregation where the decision ought to be made. Because if you are only, as a congregation, you are coerced into doing what you wish you did not have to do, that is not going to transmit faith from generation to generation. Okay, enough on that point. So our faith proposition. So then what do you stand for? The faith proposition includes, one, a biblical theology as defined by the ADC statement of beliefs. Now, when we started out, we ascribed to the 1963 Mennonite Confession of Faith, which is the Confession of Faith, or earlier, which is, yeah, it could be some churches. I mean, we're familiar with the Dordrecht Confession from 1632. We're familiar with the Schleitheim Confession, 1527, and then there have been a number of confessions since then, and the 1963 Confession is the one that kind of describes the kind of people we are. In the mainline Mennonite churches, they have had several since then confessions of faith. But this is the one that kind of described us, what we understood to be a biblical statement of faith. As we began working on this, there were some items in the 63 Confession of Faith that we found ourselves just unsatisfied with how vague it was. Take, for example, the statement on marriage. So think now. In 1963, when a statement of faith was made that talked about marriage, it was fairly straightforward, not much debate. Think of everything that has changed from 1963 to 2019. When today children don't even... Today, men my age aren't sure if they should hold open a door for a lady or not, whether it's safe to hold open a door for a lady or not, and children aren't sure which bathroom to go to. You know, so this whole question of sexuality has changed so much. In fact, I would propose that the youth that are sitting in the pews today, you will have opportunity to demonstrate what it means to be a godly man and a godly woman in a culture that has completely lost its moorings in ways that our generation never had to. And so we looked at that and said, this is an area that we better pay attention to. It's an area that we better make sure in our statement of faith that we have this, that we define it. And so we made a footnote to the statement of faith. And so finally we ended up, and then we got to, well, there wasn't anything. So in 1963, the whole digital world didn't exist, other than maybe in several large computers that the military had. And so the statement of faith was silent on that. So we found ourselves adding footnotes, and we didn't seem proper for us to be amending that statement of faith. So we eventually determined that we would kind of restate an ADC statement of, and we called it statement of beliefs, on this premise that there are things which we have said in this statement of beliefs that will change. Now, in a statement of faith, nothing should change. But in a statement of, so we defined it as a belief, because if you think about, if you look here on number, by the way, this is a, there's a brief, concise one that goes on front and back, and then there's also the full one, like the long statement that's 5,000 words. But we first sent that out, and we could tell that no one's reading the 5,000-word one. And so we reduced it to this 2 pages. I think it's like 900-some words now. But if you look at number 19, for example, holiness in media. We believe the influence of unregulated media causes us to adapt to the secular culture and values of the kingdom of this world, drawing us away from a biblical lifestyle. Recognizing that the point of conflict has shifted from electronic devices to the media content they broadcast, we refrain from the use of ungodly forms of media and content, utilizing safeguards as necessary. So, as 10 years from now, if the Lord tarries, some of you will look back at that and say, they didn't get it all. Okay, so this will change. So this is this statement of beliefs is an effort to incorporate our statement of faith and also the statements that we believe that will need to be amended as the times change. Okay, so our faith proposition includes a biblical theology as defined by the ADC statement of beliefs, a principle-based discipleship model of congregational life. We've already talked about this some, but the idea is that that when people, like sometimes we are asked, so what kind of regulations do you require? And the answer is that that's for you to decide at the local church level. But what we are interested in is a principle-based discipleship model of congregational life. To start a discipleship movement. We'll talk more about that at the later then. Also, congregational autonomy and church administration. A conservative Anabaptist worldview expressed by a lifestyle based on the Sermon on the Mount for all who enter into the kingdom of Christ. Living counterculturally to engage the secular culture in the kingdom of this world. I have to be careful here to not get into the preaching mode here, okay? When churches take this defensive posture, the world is a wicked place to live in. We better safeguard ourselves and create this cocoon, if you will, to try to defend ourselves. It seems that at best, we slow down the acculturation. We don't stop it. We slow it down at best. And so this proposal is that God's people are to live in an unabashed manner like the Sermon on the Mount. That Jesus, when Jesus said, the kingdom of heaven is at hand, and he said, if you want to enter into the kingdom, this is the way those live that enter into the kingdom. That's what our worldview is, a lifestyle based on the Sermon on the Mount. That means we are going to be countercultural. We are going to be running against the culture that is ungodly and going in a different way. And so rather than hunkering down to in a defensive posture, it's to turn and engage the culture. This is the generation for Anabaptism. This is the generation that is looking for actually the whole millennial generation, and there's those that are following after them. I mean, they're not like the baby boomers. They're looking for meaning. They're looking for values and meaning, and are getting increasingly disenchanted with what they see in their parents' generation. And they're looking for meaning. And this is an opportunity for real people who have real faith in a real God, who don't explain away what the Bible means and what Jesus meant, but who actually live the way the Bible says, just the way Jesus said it. That is going to be a message that will be increasingly welcomed. And it's tragic that far too many of our people are, instead of embracing this message and engaging the culture in which we live, even if it goes right in the face of the culture, far too many of us kind of wish we weren't there ourselves and are going the other way. So, a conservative Anabaptist worldview expressed by a lifestyle based on the Sermon on the Mount, for all who enter into the kingdom of Christ, living counterculturally to engage the secular culture in the kingdom of this world. If churches who join ADC view this affiliation as just a group of churches who have relaxed their former church standard and have now kind of made the line over here, and they continue to think like they have always thunk, they're only setting themselves up for their children to do the same thing. So this is not about just saying, so what's your standard? Can we be more acculturated? And it doesn't matter. This is about defining how God's children live according to the Sermon on the Mount in this age in which we live, in this time and place, and engaging the culture and standing on principle and holding each other accountable through discipleship. That's what this is about. Okay, number five. Equal emphasis on the two great calls of the church: to make disciples by evangelizing unbelievers and by nurturing believers. The two great calls of the church: to evangelize and to nurture. And I would propose to you that we as a people have far too much so have made kind of this, I'm going to say subconscious, I don't think it was even as much conscious as subconscious, consciously, we have made this deal where we said it's okay to go easy and shortchange evangelism so that we can be safe. And so we're strong on nurture and we're very weak on evangelism. And we have created this kind of a seesaw effect. And if you think about that, let's just take here the churches in America, where there are some churches who are very strong on evangelism and very weak on nurturing, or let's say living out their faith. Strong on evangelism, weak on living it out. And there are others who are strong on living it out, kind of weak on evangelism. And if we look at history, throughout history, when the people of God have evangelism and nurture on parallel tracks, there is strength among God's people, and the kingdom advances, and the devil is angry. And I would propose to you that if you go to look at areas of persecution and times of persecution throughout the Christian era, you'll find that during the time that in those times of persecution, God's people were on parallel tracks. And when we're this way or this way, the enemy relaxes. Now that's a pretty general statement, but there's a general principle there. Okay, equal emphasis on the two great calls of the church, to make disciples by evangelizing unbelievers and nurturing believers. Two offices for local church governance. This one is not as significant as some of the other points, but it is an area that we have been asked about, and so we put it in here to define that it seems to us that in the biblical pattern for church governance, there are two offices that are identified, which include one, bishops, elders, pastors, and the other, deacons for church benevolence ministries. And so our proposition also includes utilizing spiritually gifted lay brethren in congregational life. The idea is this. In my father's generation, there were preachers. They preached when it was their turn. And the bishop kept house in the church. And if the deacon showed up on your porch during the week, there was trouble. And it was for you. And so you were told to straighten up or be disciplined. And I'm not sure how it all worked, but it seemed like people straightened up and life went on, okay? But something has changed, and I'm not sure what it is. Maybe it's the millennial influence. Maybe it's that as the digital era comes upon us, yeah, we're just bombarded with information, and we seem to understand ourselves better now. So that there's this escalation of expectations for pastoral ministry, to the point where now, if the pastor does not show up on the porch during the week, there's trouble. But it's for him, not for you. Because obviously he's not caring about your. He's uninvolved, too distant, and so on. But you understand what I'm saying. There's this escalation of need. Maybe the times bring that upon us as well. There's also But we've kept the same model for church leadership and administration. A bivocational model where we didn't used to know what the words like sabbatical meant. We thought it was something the Jews do on the Sabbath, isn't it? Or what burnout meant. That happened to like corporate executives. And now we hear those terms used about our church leaders. And it's not sustainable. So what's the answer? Well, there's one thought is, well, then you need a salaried ministry. I'm proposing that there is another path forward. And the path forward is utilizing spiritually gifted lay brethren in congregational life. Sometimes church leaders, by the way, I'm not projecting this across your church leaders, but there are churches very much like yours where the leaders are have this almost like this hierarchy where only a select few can exercise their spiritual gifts in church. And so we use the terminology a flat church, where we are working to like flatten down that hierarchy and let the work of ministry be done by everyone in the church. And when the work is shared, then it's sustainable. And I can see ourselves, our people, if we are effective in utilizing spiritually gifted lay people for ministry in our churches, that's a sustainable model. I think it's a biblical model. Ephesians 4:11, and God gave unto the church apostles and prophets and evangelists and pastors and teachers. That pastors and teachers is actually, I mean, that's not like five different ones, it's four. Pastors and teachers is the one designation. To equip the saints for the work of ministry. The role of those offices is not to do the work of ministry. It's to equip the saints for work of ministry. This is an overstatement, but I've said to our congregation, you should not be bringing unbelievers to church on Sunday morning. Okay, that's a little extreme, okay? But the point is that you come to church on Sunday morning to be equipped for the work of ministry. And the work of ministry is what takes place when you go out the door to interact with unbelievers. Evangelization takes place in the great marketplace of life, where you interact with people who will hardly ever, hardly if ever, come through the doors of your church on Sunday morning. And once they're believers, that's when they then come to church to be equipped for work of ministry. So this phrase, utilizing spiritually gifted lay brethren in congregational life, wasn't just like an add-on afterthought there, but this is a key component in a sustainable congregational life in the times in which we live, where we're engaged in embracing the culture and in ministering to our culture. And an apologetic defense of biblical faith. That is just to say that among us, we have had for generations have been too much schooled to say, well, this is why do we live the way we do? Well, it's because this is the way we live. We've always done it this way. Our church says that we, and so that we, the affiliation has an interest in promoting an apologetic apology. By that doesn't mean to apologize, but apologetics, you know, to defend the faith, to defend the biblical faith. And we're going to have to be pretty good at that if we're going to engage the culture and explain and demonstrate how God's people live when the culture is saying, that's all a myth. So, and that's how apologetic defense of biblical faith made its way into the faith proposition. Okay, so that's the faith proposition. So how do congregations decide to join this affiliation? Well, we require a voluntary participation by congregation, ratified by church vote. So what this means is that just the way churches are not best served by members who wish they weren't there. I don't know why we just keep on insisting people become members, stay members of our churches if they wish they weren't there. Is that safe to say? It's no wonder people often don't invite others to church if they themselves wish they weren't there. So I guess let this a reality check. Let's just say what it is, and then so voluntary part, and it's the same way in the affiliation with congregations. We really are not interested in having congregations who wish they were somewhere else, but this is just a place to be because, well, it's safe. But the congregation must wish to become engaged in this way of congregational living. And so we require, and we don't say it has to be a vote by, you know, like like 85% or unanimous. It's just however you as a congregation do your voting. You must probably have a way of kind of determining what's going to carry and what won't, and so however you do that. But it's not prescribed by the affiliation. Agreement with ADC's purpose, function, and faith proposition. We've just talked about those three things there. Our purpose, our function, and faith proposition. Agreement with ADC's statement of beliefs. participation in the annual assemblies for pastoral fellowship and congregational accountability. We do highly, we first said you have to be there. If your church is going to be a member, then your pastors have to be there. And, that's overstating it. But we highly encourage, because that's how congregational accountability works. We associate with each other, and we spend time together. And so we really encourage participation in the annual assemblies. And then also by providing mutual aid and support to ADC-affiliated congregations. So does that mean we're making a financial commitment here? No, it's not that at all. It just means that we help each other. So when there are things that come up and it's something that is larger than your congregation can address, then you have someone to turn to and we help each other, is the idea. Providing voluntary financial support for ADC operating expenses. There are some operating expenses. By the way, we do have a website. Google Anabaptist Disciples of Christ and we'll come up. And everything you see here this evening is on the website. Also the list of churches that are participating churches and so on. And and recordings of our past assemblies and so forth. So that's one expense we have. And other than it's not an expensive proposition, but there are expenses to meet. And so we talked about what should we have, an assessment plan where it's so much a member or how do we do this? And we said, oh, let's just say that congregations that are participating should just make a voluntary contribution, and that is working very well. Ample funds for the expenses. We do for our annual assembly. We hold it, and we've held it twice in the Columbus area, at a convention center there in Columbus, North Side, and then this past January in Belleville, Ohio, where we used the Der Dutchman restaurant, meeting room and eating room, and then we stayed just across the parking lot at the Comfort Inn. So. And there are some expenses associated with that, so we kind of put together a budget and we say this is what the speakers, we reimburse the speakers that come. So this is kind of what it costs, but we do not want anyone to not come because of the cost. So there is we've had ample funds to enable this to happen. So, but it's by voluntary support from participating congregations. So, what if someone no longer fits? Is there a mechanism to usher them to the exit door? In the spirit in which we operate as an affiliation, all we say is at the time that a congregation decides to participate, they also acknowledge that they will voluntarily withdraw if they're out of alignment with our affiliation agreement and our statement of beliefs. So it's not that the police, the ADC police won't come around to check up. It's a voluntary withdrawal if a congregation finds itself out of alignment. We do have a planning committee. It's like we're not a conference, and so we kind of say, so what should we have? So the most authority we could find could give to anyone was to have a planning committee, and so the planning committee plans for the assemblies and we're part of the founders and so on, but we're also the ones who are like now moving ahead with like organizing. An election for a mission board, but the mission board will then be separate. That'll be a separate decision-making unit. But you contact the planning committee for an ADC membership participation commitment. That's quite the mouthful there. Actually, we've taken the membership out and just says church participation commitment form. That's the way it looks. And it just kind of says, here's who we are as a church. And we hereby affirm that we've taken a vote that we would like to participate. And you can be a participating church. Questions? I might add that this is a work in progress. We've so we started out like I'll be candid here. So a number of us of the congregations that you will see that are participating churches were the ones who found themselves no longer fitting in the Beachy constituency, and so we were all independent, and we. And we could have decided that we actually did consider just continuing independently, and then as the burden for ministry, international ministry in particular, kind of on the we do have one area of ministry that is being brought to us as a great opportunity and a great need is the Syrian refugee crisis on the Greek islands and the way these refugees work themselves up through the Balkan Peninsula and into Europe. That there's a sense in, you might look at it this way, sometimes we look for and ask the question, well, where does God want me to be? But you, why don't we say, where is God at work? Wherever God is at work, and the needs are great, why don't we just kind of like get into alignment with wherever God is at work? And in this, I mean, there are 68 million refugees, displaced people, who have come out of Syria and on east, and Africa, many of them from countries that missionaries can't go there legally. And so God is bringing those millions out of that those countries, and they're all flowing across those islands up through the Balkan Peninsula. And so there is a great opportunity there for church planting. And so that's one area of focus. So as we kind of looked at that, we said, you know, it would make sense for us to help each other. And so we kind of joined ourselves together to hold each other accountable while preserving autonomy, and helping one another in ministry. Okay, I think it's time to bring this to a close. I'll turn it back to you, Jason. And if you have any other questions, feel free to ask any time. Sometimes we have answers and sometimes we don't. And if we don't, we'll tell you that we don't know.